Hi, Frank.
Hello, Bob.
How are you doing?
Very well.
Good. You're in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I'm in my office at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Okay, well, that takes care of part of the introduction for me. You're at MIT. You're a professor of physics there. You're Frank Wilczek. You've also won a Nobel Prize, and we'll talk a little later about what you won that for. I wanted to start out by asking you about something I read in your book, The Lightness of Being, which is not to be confused with The Unbearable Lightness of Being, right? Different books.
Yeah, right? Being is is bearable as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, good. I myself have doubts, but we don't have to have that argument. So anyway, you say in the book that as a child you very much liked the idea that there was a hidden meaning behind the surface appearance of things, right?
Yes.
What did you, I mean, in what ways, what kinds of meanings did you hope were there?
Well, in the crudest sense, I was very interested in magic, in you know, what magicians did, things that didn't seem out of the ordinary. So I of course thought that it was that they were calling on extra forces somehow, that I didn't, you know, secret powers that I really wanted to know about. That that was one thing. And then that was probably the original feeling along those lines. But then I grew up in sort of the Catholic tradition, so I got instructed in the catechism, and it was very interesting to hear about this whole unseen world that was behind ours. And then I learned about science and got another dose of unseen worlds. So all of that fed into
And it. Was there a conflict? Was there an incompatibility among those several kinds of unseen worlds?
Well, definitely. Well, not I wouldn't say incompatibility, but definitely tension. Of course, you know, when I learned about magic and the tricks that magicians do, that was very disillusioning because they're just
tricks. You thought you would actually be harnessing supernatural forces
exactly,
to learn magic?
Exactly, right. Yeah, I took it I took it at face value. But that didn't last long. I actually learned how to do some of the tricks.
And what about the religious part?
Well, the religious part is more complicated, of course. You know, the claims are much more sophisticated. And are partly matters of fact, partly matters of advice, partly matters of tradition. As I learned more about science, I learned that there's considerable tension as to the matters of fact, the account of the origin of the world. But most of all, I guess what bothered me, the biggest tension I found was sort of a difference of scale and approach. I mean, the scientific account of the world had a kind of surprise and grandeur and coherence that wasn't immediately evident in the religious account. I mean, you know, this, the text seemed to have altogether too much interest in Middle Eastern real estate, and didn't.
That's a surface reading.
Yes, I guess it. But it's a the surface goes pretty deep there, and and you know, and there was a lot, and so much was missing. I mean, there's nothing in there about the fact that the stars are so far away, that they're like our sun, that their space is so grand, that things are so old, that our planet is this little thing. And on the other side, that there are irregularities to the behavior of things in the physical world that you could understand.
So forced to choose between science and religion, you'd take science, it sounds like.
Well, as to matters of fact, yeah. And I went through a long period in which I felt that that was sort of maybe if not all there is, but the central thing, and that there wasn't much to be salvaged from the traditional, the traditions. I've kind of changed my attitude about that a little bit. Because I've seen that having those beliefs and being in a community, well, first of all, that the beliefs can be modulated. They can be made to accommodate, the matters of fact, of course, are non-negotiable, but there's a lot more to it than claims about facts about the world. There's mm-hmm. tradition, there's community, and I've come to see, sort of living my life, that can be very valuable to people. People mm-hmm. who are in need or aged or just lonely can derive mm-hmm. a lot of comfort and satisfaction and support from mm-hmm. participating in that.
Is it too personal a question to ask if you're still involved with the church?
I'm not. No, I'm not.
You're not. Okay.
But I've been toying with the idea of maybe, you, probably not the Catholic you, Church, but maybe the Unitarians becoming, or the Buddhists or something like that.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm actually going on a meditation retreat next week, so maybe you should come along and sample the Buddhist thing. But in this book of yours, The Lightness of Being, you seem to hold out hope that a deeper meaning can be found through science,
yes.
deeper than is apparent to us now, right? I mean,
who's us? I mean, yeah. I mean, there definitely are deeper meanings. I mean, you can't understand the world properly unless you come to terms with the very, very deep, profound, and surprising things that we've discovered by centuries of scientific investigation. We've
right.
learned that the world is a much, much bigger, much, much older, and much stranger place than appears to common sense or everyday experience. There's much, much more
right.
to it. Our senses are paltry compared to what's out there.
Seem to be, yes. About 100 years ago, physics started encountering things that seem a little bit on the unintelligible side. That is to say, that are very hard to make sense of given kind of human...
They're very different from everyday life. The way
the
way small things behave in particular... with quantum mechanics
mm-hmm.
is very, very different than the way things we encounter in everyday life and have our rules of thumb about how to interact with. It's very different
right.
from that. And the only way to understand it is to study the equations and play with them and get experience and sort of see how they react to tweaking and work in different circumstances.
Yeah, and even there, I mean, even once you get the equations to work and understand how they work, which I can't say I do, there seems to remain a gap between, our kind of way of thinking about things and the quantum world, and therefore room for interpretation. You know, there are interpretations of quantum physics. You
yes.
wouldn't say the same about other kinds of science, necessarily, that there are different interpretations,
Probably,
right.
Yeah, I can't easily think of an example on this where there are disputes on the same level, so to speak. Where
right.
Most practitioners, well, basically all competent practitioners, I think, agree on what you're supposed to do when you apply the equations and how to describe actual experiments. But sort of what it means at a metaphysical level.
Right.
People have different reactions to, which is
right.
Let me give you odd.
Sorry, go ahead.
That's a really odd thing. Yeah.
It is. Let me take an example, and I'm sure I'll botch this in the exposition, but you'll know what I mean and can straighten me out. But anyway, it's It's this idea that at a quantum level, sometimes reality, in a certain sense, doesn't take firm shape until it's measured.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So
Yes. The
idea is, suppose, and I'm not sure this is the kind of question you'd ask, but suppose the question is this particle here or there right now?
Yes.
And according to one interpretation, I think, of quantum physics, the answer is, until you've done the measurement, there is no answer. In other words, the closest thing to an answer is, well, there's a 30% chance it's here, there's a 40% chance it's here, and there's a 30% chance it's here. And that is just the reality. It is nowhere, or it is everywhere, but it is in no one place until there's this act of measurement, at which point the probability function is forced to collapse, and suddenly you can say, okay, this is where it is. Now,
yes, well, quantum mechanics teaches you that you have to be very careful in formulating your questions. You can formulate questions that seem to make grammatical sense, but that don't really correspond to any experience, mm-hmm. and those kind of questions the theory doesn't necessarily answer.
Right.
So, yeah.
And then I've heard two different interpretations, at least, of what this means. Some people say that all that's required for the particle to assume a definite location is for it to kind of encounter the physical measuring instrument. And then I've heard some people say, no, you actually need an observer. So they even get metaphysical and say, consciousness is required, a mind is required to bring this part of reality into definite shape, right? I think I've heard kind of reputable physicists even say this, right?
Previously reputable.
Oh, previously reputable. So are they now...
Some very reputable.
Are the David Bohms of the world now dismissed as hopeless mystics, or...?
Well, I think most impressive probably is Eugene Wigner, who's really one of the great heroes of modern physics.
Who, and that was his interpretation?
Yeah, who explicitly brought in consciousness in the requirement of that a conscious observer at some stage make an observation before you could talk about what something actually happening. I think that's a fringe point of view, and certainly not what I subscribe to myself.
Yeah, although I've got to say, I can't see why encountering a measuring instrument would have some sort of metaphysically transforming effect. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like if the particle bumps into something that human beings have defined as a measuring instrument, something magical happens. Where if it just bumps into ordinary matter, nothing. I don't get it. You know?
No, I agree with you. So that's why I think measuring instruments should be considered as ordinary matter themselves, and you have to. What happens is that different events get correlated. So what you have is a correlation between the position of the particle and the rest of the world that it's interacting with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definite. So if the rest of the world is in a distinguishable state, whether it's because of some explicit observer or measuring instrument, or just because it's a significant part of the world that has a life of its own, so to speak. If your particle affects any of those and leaves a trace, leaves a scar, then its position is determined, because you have a correlation between the macroscopic, the thing that has a scar, and the particle, which is the existence of a correlation is what the equations tell you about. It doesn't tell you that A is here and B is there, but it tells you A is this far from B, roughly speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Well, I feel somewhat diminished by this interpretation. If my mind is not what's required to bring reality into existence, but I'm willing to accept your judgment. In this book of yours, The Lightness of Being, what you say at the outset, very much related to this, is, let me kind of read it. you suggest that the first step toward understanding what it's all about is to understand what it is, which is to say the universe in which we're enmeshed.
Yes.
And then you write, ah, I hear the traditional believer object, the traditional religious believer, in other words, object, but scientific study of the natural world does not reveal its meaning, to which I reply, that is, you reply, give it a chance. Should you expect to understand what it means before you know what it is? So, again, I mean, you know, there you have this idea that the more we understand the physical world, the more clues we'll have to do as to the ultimate meaning of it all, I guess.
Yes, well, I don't know if there is an ultimate meaning, but we certainly can find more and more meaning and expand our imagination as well as our knowledge by,
well, let me,
you know, looking at God's handiwork, so to speak, just looking, you know, we have...
Right.
Okay, we have sacred texts, which you can dispute about. People, the different people have different sacred texts, but we all have one common sacred text, which is the world.
Mm-hmm.
And
God,
if there is a God, went to a lot of trouble to make this world, and we should find out what it is and get the lessons from it.
Right. But I guess, I mean, when you say to look at God's handiwork, so to speak, is there any chance that science could lead us to drop the phrase, so to speak? Well, let me be clear. I don't mean is science going to show us that there's a God necessarily, but is science, might science lead us to truths of the sort, of this sort, you know, about ultimate purpose or something?
Well, first let me answer somewhat whimsically, but mm-hmm. it's a kind of thought experiment that shows you that the answer is yes in principle. There's been a lot of speculation or science fiction kind of thinking that as computers get more and more powerful and we have AI and we know how to make things to think inside computers, that we could construct worlds where you had thinking objects
mm-hmm.
that were purely virtual, but they mm-hmm. they wouldn't necessarily know that they were virtual. They were, that would be their world. And you know,
where you're heading here. But
yeah, we could have regular laws. They could have regular laws that they discovered that they would call the mm-hmm. laws of physics, which govern mm-hmm. their world. And we know that there would be behind that programmers.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So and you could imagine that these virtual creatures, by hard study of what their world was about and how it worked, and maybe finding exceptions somewhere, and, you know, monkey business when there were bugs in the program, that they would gradually figure out that they were actually, you know, living inside a world created by some programmer. That,
mm-hmm.
So it's certainly possible in principle we could find out something along those lines. The laws that we actually have discovered in physics and cosmology don't look like that. They don't give any sign of that at the moment, but it's a logical possibility. I think the sign would, I mean, I don't know, I probably would, you know it when I see it, but I mean, the kind of thing you could imagine is that you would find bugs in the program, some funny thing that was just a ridiculous, quirky change mm-hmm. in the laws. I mean, mm-hmm. a miracle, in other words. So miracles mm-hmm. would happen occasionally. They wouldn't mm-hmm. necessarily have any moral content. They would just be kind of quirky,
right.
You know, and not helping anybody particularly, just be out of the blue, I guess. You know, I don't know. So.
I guess if we saw a giant kid dropping a quarter in the universe...
Well, all of a sudden, you'd look up at the sky, and instead of seeing a nice blue sky, you'd see one pixel that was red or something. You know, then you'd know that there was a bug in the program.
Yeah. There's a guy... I once wrote a long piece for The Atlantic, and it later appeared in a book of mine about a guy you may have heard of who probably still in your... environ somewhere. He was a professor at MIT at the time. He was a computer scientist, but he actually got to teach a course called digital physics there. His name is Ed Fredkin.
Oh yeah, I know. Sure, he's a friend.
You know Ed? Well, he had this theory that, in physical terms, the theory is that the ultimate laws of the universe are more like computer algorithms,
yeah,
and the ultimate stuff of the universe is more like discrete bits.
Right. That's a program you can. And, I mean, that's a program that's really intriguing, and you can try to push it. And it might have worked, and it might still work someday. But our present laws of physics don't look like that. They really, they really use continuous variables, and they don't look terribly discrete. So
it would require
a major reworking of at least the way we do things.
Yeah, I mean, Ed said he had a workaround for all these things, but at least in principle. But
we've argued a little bit about it, and I guess, and he's got a long way to go.
Yeah, but what was funny is he inferred that there, from the fact that the universe was a computer in his view, he inferred that there was some purpose, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because in our universe, computers do have purposes, right? We instill purpose in these computers, but
right.
It seemed to me, I didn't really see that it actually had much evidentiary value whether things were digital or continuous as to whether something set the universe up to do something, you know?
Well, right. It's hard to know what the implications would be without having a more specific picture of what the laws would look like. But
okay.
Yeah. So I guess I'll refrain from speculating there. If the law somehow seemed quirky or revelatory of thought processes of the programmer who made them, that would be really interesting.
Right.
The laws we have, though, seem awfully, well, they're very beautiful in a way, but they're beautiful in a very abstract mathematical way.
Mm.
You know, so whether they're digital or analog, or whether there's some mind behind them, one thing you can say is that if there was a mind behind them, it's a very mathematically inclined mind and has an aesthetic sense that really is heavily invested in concepts of symmetry and sort of ultimate simplicity.
Okay, well, that's
a capture in a few lines.
Ultimate simplicity is a good is a thing I'd like to talk about, because you're, like many physicists, you're very interested in the prospect of a grand unified theory. I mean, we've now got physics boiled down to, I gather, four forces.
Yes.
It's electromagnetism, the strong force, the weak force, and then gravitation. Are those the
That's
four?
That's right, yes.
Okay, so you hold out hope that these can in turn be boiled down to a single, what would it be, a force? Is that what it would be, that from which these...
Well, we'll say it's an interaction, because usually when you think of a force, you think of something that just moves bodies, but this would be something that not only moves particles around, but also involves the possibility of changing one kind of particle into another.
Okay.
But force is fine, just as long as you understand that it's a more general concept.
Okay. It's a kind of force. It's kind of like a force.
Yeah, it's a force that can also transform things. Right.
Well, that's so
not
many
just
forces
moving.
Can. Okay, right. I see. A transformative force. That's what I'm looking for in my life.
Well,
I hope we find it.
You've got them.
I hope we find it. I'm not as convinced as you are that it's there, maybe, but I do hope we find it. I mean, it's an interesting assumption that...
Oh, you mean a unified theory?
Yeah, it's an interesting assumption that it's there. I mean, it's true that so far, scientific inquiry has led us to more and more simple and powerful laws. But it's possible. I mean, and this gets back to the prospect that some intelligent being built the universe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that ultimately, you know, there was some limit on how clever they could get in a certain sense. I mean, it's like suppose you're an extraterrestrial like bug that's pretty smart, and they throw you down into the middle of like an American automobile, and you're trying to figure things out.
Yes.
And you come up with these. You go like, okay, you figure out what the pistons are. You figure out what the carburetor is. You go, okay, they're all part of the power generating system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you look at the wheels, and you look at the steering wheel, and you go, okay, they're all part of the steering system. So you are successfully boiling things down, right?
Yes.
But then you get to a point where, you know, what are the steering system and the power system? What's more fundamental than that? And there just isn't an answer, you know? It's just, it's a car. I mean, you know.
No, it could, right, it could have been that the form of the laws suggested a kind of engineering design, that the different forces were meant to do different things somehow, and they looked very different, and that putting them together was kind of a kludge. But but that's not the way it is. I mean, three of the forces are based on our description of that, I should say, which is very, very successful in describing very accurate, demanding experiments. The mathematical form of our formulation of three of the laws, the strong, weak, and electromagnetic, are very similar. They really have a family resemblance, a very, very strong family resemblance. And they're based, as we alluded to before, on this idea of tremendous amounts of symmetry in the equations.
Okay.
There are lots and lots of things that you can do to the equations that don't change them. That's what we mean by symmetry. Things that would change an arbitrary set of equations because these equations are particularly simple and nice. If you make the transformations, change x into y and y into x, you get the same equation. So that's been a very powerful principle in more sophisticated forms to lead us to the laws.
Okay.
And then, but so then, really, when we're talking about a unified theory, what we're talking about is having even more beautiful equations with even more symmetry. And that could be right idea, it could be wrong idea, but it's something that you can build on. You know, the worst thing is if you have no idea, that's one idea for how to improve our description of the world. What's remarkable to me is that nature is giving us some encouragement. There are some consequences that you get from that idea that explain things that are otherwise unexplained about what we already know. And then
what's an example?
Well, we know there are many, many kinds of particles that have been observed that within the standard model, within this idea that within the present formulation where there are separate forces, are unrelated. And so you're left wondering why there are all these different kinds of particles with different properties that don't seem related in any attractive way. It's kind of random. But if you make the bigger theory, then suddenly everything clicks into place. All the unrelated particles are now related. We know just why there are the particles there are not are the ones with different properties. It's a much more coherent presentation of the world as we know it. And furthermore, explains why the different forces look different, even though they're fundamentally the same. They have different powers. That's the reason we call the weak force weak, is that it's weaker than the strong force. But if these ideas of unification are right, then really, at a deeper level, they're equal. They're aspects of the same kind of process or interaction. And we can use our theory to extrapolate to shorter distances, kind of peeling away the complications that come from space being a medium that alters the apparent properties of particles. When we trace back the basics, we find that, in fact, the different interactions do seem to have the same power. So that's really very tantalizing.
Okay.
But it only works if quantitatively in detail, if you have this idea called supersymmetry, which is beautiful in itself, but also really makes the story special because it's something you can test experimentally. So finally, out of all this kind of decades of speculation dating back at least to Einstein in the modern era, but long before, about achieving a unified theory that has everything or close to everything, or at least very large parts of everything. Now we have a success, a concrete success, and a concrete way of testing whether the ideas are on the right track to push it further.
And so is the Large Hadron Collider that I guess is now cranked up going to, we think it's going to help us out here?
That's the key, I think, yeah.
We think that there are particles that have been theorized whose existence it's going to confirm, right?
Exactly, right.
That's the Higgs boson in particular?
That's one, right. And all these particles that are needed to to make supersymmetry work.
Mm-hmm. So it's the expectation of unity that leads us to believe there will be more particles than we've confirmed so far.
That's one line of thought that leads there. Other ones are, there are more concrete ones also, especially for the Higgs boson. They're very specific.
Mm. Now,
but less speculative reasons that lead us to expect its existence. So
okay.
That one is on a
now the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson confuses me a little, just based on what little I've read about it. And that brings me back to your book, The Lightness of Being, because you, I mean, first of all, let me see if I've got kind of a basic thesis of your book right, which is that, you know, ordinary intuition kind of tells us that, okay, there's this physical world consisting of massive things, massive in the sense of having mass, this
yes.
desk, me, that's the physical, tangible world. And then there's light, which just kind of illuminates the world, you know.
Yes, that's the way the world presents itself.
That's the way the world presents itself. And, of right. course, you know, when you think about it, yes, it is on the one hand part of the physical universe. We've learned that in school. But intuitively, matter or massive things seem more fundamental. And first of all, you're
they
saying
push
that's...
back, so we have to
you're
take
saying,
them into account, right?
Right, right. You, I am forced to reckon with the existence of this desk. You're saying that intuition is almost in a certain sense backwards.
Yes, that's what's come out of deeper investigation of the world. That when you penetrate into the inner essence of things, you know. Well, I should say, as background, one thing that's come out of centuries of progress in understanding the world in physics and chemistry is that the simple, regular laws can be discovered by looking at very, very small things, and then when you understand those things, you can build up the description of more complicated, bigger, more complicated things, as lots of these little basic things working together in mm-hmm. different arrangements. That's called reductionism, and whether you like it or not, it's been extremely successful in describing the world. And where were we going with this?
Talking about, in some sense, light being more fundamental
right.
than
we
realize.
Yeah, exactly, right. So when you get down to the bottom and study these smaller building blocks really deeply, this was really only becoming apparent in, I would say, in the 1970s, that you find that the fundamental particles really have much more in common with the traditional notion of light than they do with the traditional notion of matter. They're kind of moving around very fast all the time,
mm-hmm.
at the speed of light, really, many of them. And they come to be and pass away just as light gets emitted and absorbed. They obey very simple equations. You know, one of the first sciences to become really scientific was optics. People controlled the paths of light and were able to make microscopes and eyeglasses and so forth based on that. So we've discovered that light is, at a fundamental level, maybe a better metaphor for the basic building blocks of physical reality than mm-hmm. the traditional notion of solid, kind of mm-hmm. inertial, hard to move, sluggish matter.
Mm-hmm. And it may be the kind of fundamental seeming divide between light and matter is a little less fundamental. In other words,
oh, it's completely non-fundamental now. Yeah. We understand that the real thing is neither light nor matter in the traditional sense, but a kind of amalgam that has some of the properties that used to be ascribed to mm-hmm. earthy matter and some of the mm-hmm. properties that used to be ascribed to celestial light, but really is neither one or both. It's kind of, you know, it is what it is. It's mm-hmm. It's a wonderful thing, in a sense, but it's different from everyday intuition.
And the difference between it manifesting itself as light and manifesting itself as matter is just a matter of a little bit of tweaking, in a sense.
Yes, small changes in the underlying equations can make enormous changes for the mm-hmm. For the things we observe when you work out the consequences of those equations working between many, many bodies.
Okay. Now, you, we're getting back to the Higgs boson, I assure you, but one kind of surprising thing in your book was, I mean, you said it used to be thought that mass was something you couldn't create, that mass was conserved,
yes,
the way we're taught energy is conserved, the total amount in the universe stays the same, but no, with these particle accelerators, apparently, you can increase the amount of mass by some huge factor of like 30,000. So you could, in principle,
sure,
take an ounce of matter and turn it into 30,000 ounces of an ounce of mass and turn it into 30,000 ounces of mass.
Yes,
in principle,
it would be very expensive, but you could.
It would be expensive, but you know, what's a few dollars when you're having fun?
It would be on the scale of bailing out a major bank.
we could end a couple of wars and afford it with no trouble whatsoever.
Yeah.
So these particle accelerators like the Large Hadron Collider apparently can create mass. But the thing that I can't wrap my mind around about this Higgs boson, mm-hmm. which is what we're trying to find with this particle accelerator, was this phrase that the Higgs boson is the particle that imbues other particles with mass. That's at least the way it's put in the kind of lay literature.
Now, well, that just, well, not by me.
But, oh, good. Okay, so but it's put that way, right?
Okay, I mean, yeah, it is, but it's dope.
But okay, put it the way it should be put.
Okay, I think the way I like to explain it is that imagine that fish became very intelligent and started to do physics.
Okay.
And they would formulate at first, based on just their observations and simplest experiments, kind of complicated laws of motion, very different from Newton's laws of motion, because they live in water, and water mm-hmm. is a medium that changes the properties of how things move and makes it very much more complicated than the motion would be without the water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's us. We've found that we can get a much nicer description of the world by postulating that we live in a medium that changes the way matter behaves, that in particular slows down how lots of particles behave, and in that way changes them from particles that move at the speed of light to particles that, since they're dragging along pieces of this medium, move slower, so they look like they have mass. That's what it is. That's that there's a medium that fills the universe that changes the properties of things, just as fish in water have their world changed by being in the water.
So this is a kind of ether.
It's a very much an ether, yeah. It's very much an ether.
Although aren't we taught in junior high that the idea of the ether that was common in the 19th century was discredited?
Well, but if you interpret those words very narrowly, they can be construed in a way that's correct, but it's basically incorrect. I mean, the ether was never discredited. And the ether is more dominant now in physics than ever. There were some very specific, detailed models of what this medium we call empty space and see as emptiness in everyday life is that had flaws, and they were discredited. But our modern physics is absolutely built from A to Z on the idea that space is a rich medium full of structure.
So there's no empty space. There's no empty space.
There's no true empty space in the sense of void. Space is full of fields that can vibrate, that have spontaneous activity, and really, though, that's the primary ingredient of reality. Particles are just excitations of this medium, kind of bubbles or waves inside this medium, which is always there and everywhere. Is really in modern physics the primary ingredient of reality. Particles and what we consider ordinary matter are just secondary manifestations.
Okay. So then what does this tell us about what the relationship is between the Higgs boson and the existence of mass in particles?
Well, so we postulated this medium, and it figures in our equations. We get much more beautiful equations with it than without it. So, in fact, we wouldn't be able to construct a satisfactory description of the world without this medium. So, we need it. But it has consequences that some of its consequences have been checked. A lot of them. That's what we mean by saying it leads to better equations. But some of its more dramatic, one of its most dramatic consequences has not been checked. It's as if these fish, found that they could get better, simpler laws of motion by postulating that they lived in water, but hadn't yet resolved the atomic structure of water, didn't know what it was made out of, hadn't been able to excite waves in it and play with it, so to speak. And that's where we are as far as this medium that fills space is concerned. We think it's there because it gives us successful equations, but we certainly haven't resolved its atomic structure. We don't know what it's made out of. We haven't produced waves in it that have consequences, and that's what the Higgs boson is supposed to be. It's supposed to be what this medium is made out of. And by the way, one says the word Higgs boson as if it denoted something very definite and specific, but actually, it's just. I mean, the way I think what we know about is this medium. Mm-hmm. We don't know that it's made out of one thing. It could be made out of several different kinds of particles. Mm-hmm. We know that it's not made out of any of the particles we currently know. They don't have the right properties. But it could be made out of several different things. It doesn't have to be one particle.
It sounds to me like maybe particle is a misnomer for the Higgs boson. I mean, if you said the particles we know about are in a sense excitations or vibrations in this medium, and the Higgs boson could be the thing the medium is made of, I would suggest you call it something other than a particle. Not that you need to take my advice on these things.
Well, by particle, we mean an excite. So all the particles are excitations in their media.
Right.
There's a medium that's the electron field. There's a medium that's the quark field and so forth. So when these media have excitations that are localized concentrations of energy, uh-huh. that move along in a definite way, we call them particles. So really, the media are the primary objects, but they can support these kinds of disturbances or excitations that are localized concentrations of energy that move along, and those are what we call particles.
Yeah. Okay. I'll get back to you on that when I after reflecting on it. When you describe a particle as a vibration in a medium, it reminds me a little of what, you know, kind of the layperson's description of string theory that I've heard of, which mm-hmm. is that particles are that the fundamental stuff is, they don't say media, they say strings, and then different particles are vibrations in the vibrations of different frequencies in the strings. Is that kind of the idea behind string theory?
Yes, it's part of it. It's one of the major ideas of string theory is that mm-hmm. That the particles we know about have internal structure mm-hmm. that can be, under the right circumstances, excited so that they will vibrate and look like other kinds of particles or have their mm-hmm. different kinds of behavior.
And what's your take on string theory? I mean,
it needs work.
Apparently, like it's never been subjected to any sort of empirical test, which is one thing we prefer to be able to do with theories.
Yeah, it's kind of vague. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some impressive aspects to it. There are a lot of interesting mathematics has come out, and some kind of vague resemblance to some of the things we encounter in the physical world, but when you know the word string theory gives the impression that there's an actual theory with equations mm-hmm. and a mapping between the concepts that appear in the theory and phenomena. Mm-hmm. It's not that way, really. It's a work in progress. It's kind of more the hope for a theory than an actual theory.
Okay. And then there's this other issue that I have with it, and maybe you're curious as to what that issue is, but in any event, I'm going to take the liberty of telling you, which is, according to string theory, there's like all these additional dimensions, you know, of course,
yes.
beyond the three that are, you know, the three spatial dimensions plus time.
Yes.
And, you know, when you say to these string theory advocates, well, wait, you know, I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around this, they say, well, don't worry, the dimensions are really small,
yes.
you know. And I'm like, that doesn't help. First of all, I thought it was part of a dimension that it was infinite, okay, the way I had been thinking about dimensions.
Right.
And secondly, you know, you're telling me that the upside of string theory is that it simplifies, right? Ultimately, it has a unifying effect, you know. My feeling is if you got to throw in like nine extra dimensions, you have not simplified my conception of physical reality. And I actually mean that. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that's not simplicity, right? No.
Well, certainly throwing in extra things without rhyme or reason is not simplicity.
Right.
The hope is that by expanding the equations, you make them more symmetric so you can see things that at present seem to be unrelated are actually related mm-hmm. if you allow bigger equations that have more structure
mm-hmm.
or, you know, physically, if you could imagine, for instance, something you mentioned that you could instead of two fundamentally different kinds of particles, you could realize that they were just one thing, like a string vibrating in different ways. That could be progress.
Yeah, that's progress.
There's
a similar issue with more conventional physics, which is that you get unity by positing a larger number of particles sometimes, right? You simplify the math, you unify the math by increasing the number of particles. Is that wrong?
No, it's not wrong, but it's misleading.
Okay.
You increase the number of particles that are observed as particles, but they are understood at a deeper level as all manifestations of one particle, one mm-hmm. kind of thing, seen in different circumstances. And that's related to the idea of extra dimensions, although it's a more general idea. The idea is, but let's talk about it in the context of extra dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about dimensions, what we mean is that if you want to specify where something is, you have to specify three numbers. Or if you want to specify an event, you have to specify four numbers, you know, four, three directions at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have extra dimensions that are small, there are additional numbers. And the idea is that those additional numbers don't tell you where you are in the sense of the location in a big world, mm-hmm. but rather what kind of particle you are, what kind of particle you are, what kind of object. So the same object, if it lives in different places in the extra dimensions, will look like a different object.
Mm.
That's so it can look like several different objects, and that's a way of getting unity by having mm-hmm. this. And it really, it's really much more general than string theory, and in fact, is already in the standard model. We have these private spaces, so it's very well established. This ideal sounds fantastic, but it is true. At least it corresponds to our best description of the world, that there are little private spaces in which the particles move. And it's by being in different places in those private spaces that they can appear to be different particles. It's really just one kind of thing, but in a different place in mm-hmm. those extra dimensions or private spaces.
So I should think of these little these dimensions as like little closets, kind of, or something.
Yeah, like a costume closets where you can get dressed in different costumes.
Uh huh. Okay.
Right.
That helps. okay. Now we had said we'd talk a little about what you won your Nobel Prize for.
Sure.
Which I gather is called asymptotic freedom.
Yeah. Well, it's really much simpler.
Good. I'm happy to hear that.
Well, we talked about there being four basic forces.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the strong force. That's the force that we now understand holds quarks and gluons together to make protons and neutrons and make atomic nuclei and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did, David Gross and I, is figure out what the equations for the strong force are and how, and equally important, how to prove that those are the right equations. And the way you prove that they're the right equations is that they predict that the interactions of quarks and gluons at high energy becomes weaker than it is at low energy. In fact, it kind of turns off, so that the behavior of these fundamental constituents of matter at high energy is very, very simple. They're free. That's why it's called asymptotic.
They're not constrained by their proximity to one another, or they're not
that's
constrained.
For instance, So in fact, when they get close to it, it's a force that, according to this theory, which is now very well tested and confirmed by the Royal Academy of Sweden, is that when the quarks or gluons are very close to each other, the force is comparatively weak. So unlike most forces, which get stronger as things become closer together, the strong force has this mm-hmm. somewhat paradoxical property of turning off.
Certainly in the realm of human events, that would be paradoxical. I find that the closer you get to people, the less freedom from them you have.
The harder they are to ignore.
To get rid of, yes.
Yeah, but quarks and gluons, they ignore the close-by guys, and it's only when it's absence makes the heart grow fonder. When they get far apart, then they realize that they really don't want to be separated.
They should be pulled back toward the other one.
Right.
Okay. So, well, that sounds like worth, not that I'm fit to judge, but I would have given you a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, it really is a very major thing. Because there are only four forces, so figuring out one of them is pretty good. But also the form of the solution is very important, because the fact that things get simple at high energies and short distances means that you can start to think about the early universe, where things were, you know, much denser and much hotter, so things were close together and at high energy,
mm-hmm.
you can actually figure out its properties. and also at accelerators where you dump a lot of energy into small spaces, you can figure out what's going to happen. And also, if you want to get unity and test these, and you know, the different forces to become equal, the strong force has to get weaker and the weak force has to get stronger so that they can come together, and this asymptotic mm-hmm. freedom makes that possible.
Hmm.
So it had, you know, well, I don't want to, well, it's great. No question
if you,
that it's
if
great.
If you do say so yourself. Okay. If you do say so yourself.
We could argue about how great the discoverers were, but I don't think you can argue that the discovery is really great, because it's been it's changed the face of fundamental physics.
Okay. Well, I'll let you adopt the humble stance that the greatness of the discovery does not imply the greatness of the discoverer. And I'll leave it for viewers to make their own judgments. So, thanks. This has been great. It's clarified some things.
Very good.
And not clarified some others, but it's but you know.
Well, you know, there's a reason we have graduate schools in physics.
Right. I blame the physical universe for that, not you.
Well, it's been hundreds of years of continuous progress and refinement and hard experiments and gradual accumulation of knowledge. It's one of the mm-hmm. great things about physics is that it's really progressive,
mm-hmm.
And so. The downside is that there's a lot to learn if you really want to get to the current frontier.
Yeah.
And also that it's very strange. I mean, it didn't have to be that way, but it does turn out that the laws, the fundamental laws, are very different from the rules of thumb we use in everyday life.
Yeah, which I guess just reflects the fact that we were designed by natural selection to deal with the macroscopic level of physical reality, right?
That's the accepted explanation, yes.
Do you have another one? I'd love
No. Just since this is the Templeton site, I thought maybe we should.
A few kind words. If you could close with a few kind words about God, that would be really appreciated. Okay. Well, I'll let you get back to making scientific progress.
All right. Very good. It was a joy.
Thank you. Thanks. All right, bye.